From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a live debate between Jay McMahon and Dan Shores, the two Republican primary candidates for state attorney general. They're running for the right to challenge Democrat Maura Healey, who they say has focused too much time and energy suing the Trump administration. Healey disagrees.
This is about fighting to ensure that women have access to reproductive health care, fighting to make sure that students aren't getting ripped off, fighting to make sure we don't go backwards when it comes to combating climate change. It's about standing up for civil rights.
Also today, local reaction to President Trump's nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to become the next Supreme Court justice. A former Boston Law School dean calls him a great choice. The state's top Democrats, not so much.
He's got someone who will be committed to overturn Roe versus Wade and someone who it looks pretty likely will help Donald Trump if he gets into serious criminal trouble.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and let's begin today with President Trump's nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to succeed retiring Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. Trump praised Kavanaugh as one of the finest and sharpest legal minds in our time. He currently serves on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. He also teaches at Harvard. Kavanaugh is a veteran of a number of explosive partisan battles, including the Whitewater investigation, which led to the impeachment of President Bill Clinton. He also worked for former President George W. Bush. He clerked for Justice Anthony Kennedy. So, if he's confirmed by the Senate, what kind of justice will Brett Kavanaugh be? And how far to the right would he push the nation's high court? Joining me are two people with local roots who know Judge Kavanaugh, Nancy Gertner, a former federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Nancy Gertner, always good to see you.
Good to be here.
Also with us is Ron Cass. He's Dean Emeritus of Boston University School of Law. He's on the line with us from Virginia. Dean Cass, good to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you again.
And I'll start with you, Mr. Cass. You know Brett Kavanaugh personally. Tell me your reaction to his selection.
Well, I think it's a terrific selection. I've known Brett for more than two decades. He's a very nice, very thoughtful, very kind person. He's a great judge. He's somebody who has a deep commitment to the rule of law. He's got credentials, as you mentioned, that are stellar credentials. But more than that, he's very thoughtful, very measured, and very committed to following precedent and to obeying the law and to seeing that the law is interpreted and applied in a reasonable and predictable way.
Let's hear a little bit of Brett Kavanaugh. Here he is speaking last night after being nominated, announced as the nominee by President Trump.
My judicial philosophy is straightforward. A judge must be independent and must interpret the law, not make the law. A judge must interpret statutes as written, and a judge must interpret the Constitution as written, informed by history and tradition and precedent.
So, Nancy, let me come to you. There he is talking about a judge interpreting the law, not making the law. What's your reaction to this nomination?
Well, I have two reactions. One is that he was on the slate of candidates prepared by the Heritage Foundation and by the Federalist Society. Clearly, he gave someone assurances with respect to the hot-button issues of our day. If he were, in fact, a black box, which is what that comment would suggest, interpret the law, take it wherever it goes, I can assure you he would not have been on that list. And in addition, as Dean Cass knows, the Constitution is phrased in very general terms, was the product of compromise. There's a range of reasonable interpretations, and we can be sure from things that he said in the past that he will be on the side of the range that conservative thinkers are on. There's no question about that.
Right. Dean Cass, you wouldn't disagree with that, would you? That, if Justice Kennedy was in the middle of this ideological divide on the Supreme Court, Justice Kavanaugh would push it more toward the conservative side.
Well, the first thing I have to say is, I'm a fan of Judge Gertner's as well. We've known each other a long time. I don't agree at all with the notion that he gave anyone assurances of anything. I've been through the presidential appointment process 6 times. I never was asked for and never gave any assurances, and I can certainly guarantee that when the president's list was put together for him, nobody on that list was asked for any guarantee or gave any. As to the question of where the court would move, certainly Judge Kavanaugh has been someone who's been a committed textualist, a committed originalist. As Judge Gertner said, those are modes of interpreting the Constitution that often are associated with conservatives, but they don't always lead to conservative results. Justice Scalia was a committed originalist and textualist. He was one of the people who was hardest core in protecting criminal defendants' rights of confrontation. So I think we shouldn't be too quick to jump to assigning a place on the spectrum to the next judicial appointment.
Let me read just a quick passage here from the New York Times writing about Judge Kavanaugh this morning. He has written countless decisions applauded by conservatives on topics including the Second Amendment, religious freedom, and campaign finance, but they have particularly welcomed his vigorous opinions hostile to administrative agencies, a central concern of the modern conservative legal movement. Nancy, what does that tell us about Judge Kavanaugh? Or I'm sure you've got your own ideas in terms of particular issues that he will touch.
Well, the administrative state issue is an interesting issue. Judge Gorsuch, likewise, is hostile to administrative interpretations. He believes the court should not necessarily cede to administrative agencies the discretion to interpret the law. That is an approach that puts at risk environmental protection, equal employment regulations, puts at risk a whole host of things. But I want to go back to the slate issue. There has never been, and correct me if I'm wrong, Rudy, that if there has never been a president who has had a slate of nominees on which he has run. So Trump says to people, I'm going to appoint pro-life judges, and here's my slate. So somebody somewhere is being assured that's what's the nature of this is going to be. So I don't think that anyone has ever gone through judicial selection in the way that President Trump has done it. Hmm. In addition, he vigorously he gave a speech to the American Enterprise Institute praising the dissent in Roe v. Wade. He has dissented. He dissented in the case involving the young immigrant woman who was 17, who was pregnant, and he dissented and was the rest of the court went the other direction. One can go through his writings. Actually, the thing that I am more concerned about than abortion even is his position with respect to presidential power. In the Minnesota Law Review article that people are talking about now, he made it clear that he believed in a robust view of presidential power. The president and the attorney general, he says, could define and monitor the independent counsel's jurisdiction. The president, the special prosecutor, should be removable at will to the president. That the president has the absolute discretion when he can be investigated and who to do the investigating. That forecasts a very troubling Supreme Court with respect to the issues that are bound to come up on the scope of Mueller's investigation.
Mm. What do you think about that, Dean Cass? He did make this reference to the fact, suggesting that sitting presidents should not be subjected to civil suits or criminal proceedings because they're simply too busy. Is that a concern when we do have a special investigation going on into, the possibility that the Trump campaign colluded with the Russians?
Well, the question of a process against a sitting president is one that was on the table when Bill Clinton was in office. It's one that a number of people who were close to the Clintons have since said the court got wrong in the Clinton against Jones case. You know, I think that when you look at Justice Breyer's opinion in that case, you can see that there are a range of reasonable positions on that are protective of the president and concerned about interference with his carrying out his duties.
Yeah.
As to the bigger question of the administrative state, the Chevron case, which deals with the deference given by courts to agencies, which is what Judge Gertner was talking about, is one that was vigorously defended at different times by liberals as well as conservatives, and vigorously attacked by both sides as well. I'm like Judge Kavanaugh, a skeptic about some uses of the Chevron doctrine, because I don't think that courts should be deferring to agencies on interpretation of law. They should defer to agencies on the exercise of legal discretion. And I think that that's been a confusion that this particular case led to. I don't think the case meant to make a change in that, and those involved in it have said as much since then.
I want to come back, though, to this point that Nancy made. And Nancy, I'll come back to you on this, this idea that presidents should not be subjected to civil suits or criminal proceedings. Would this even come before him, this issue? In other words, let's say the president gets into hot water because of Bob Mueller's investigation. The response would be political, wouldn't it? That is, it would be up to Congress to act, to impeach or not to impeach. I mean, would Judge Kavanaugh even be in a position to weigh in on this?
The ultimate decision of impeachment is surely political. But if you go back to the Nixon White House, the Supreme Court had to weigh in on the question of whether or not the president had to produce tapes. The Supreme Court may have to weigh in on the enforceability of subpoenas, may have to weigh in on the scope of the investigation. There are a host of issues that could come up that frame the investigation, even if the ultimate decision is the decision of the Congress. And as to those, he's made it quite clear that he bends in favor of giving the president substantial discretion. And I have really, I'd like to know very much. I hope that the hearings bring out what assurances were given, what was told to the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation so that they would put their imprimatur on this candidate.
Dean Kass, last question to you. What do you hope comes out of these hearings, other than a sort of first-class political battle between Republicans and Democrats?
Actually, what I hope comes out of it is a speedy confirmation of somebody who would be a terrific addition to the court.
All right. Well, that's Ron Kass. He's Dean Emeritus of Boston University School of Law. Dean Kass, thank you so much for joining us today. We're very grateful.
Always a pleasure.
Take care.
And Nancy Gertner, former federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's legal analyst. Nancy, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, a live debate between the two Republican candidates running for state attorney general. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. And let's turn now to statewide politics and the race for attorney general and the two Republicans vowing to oust Democrat Maura Healey as the state's top law enforcer, Jay McMahon and Dan Shores. Healey has received a lot of national attention for filing dozens of legal actions against the Trump administration in support of immigrants, environmental protection, and consumer rights, among other issues. The two Republicans running against her argue these actions are not in the best interests of Massachusetts residents. They hope to take on Maura Healey in November, but before that, they'll face off against each other in the Republican primary on September 4th. Jay McMahon and Dan Shores are both Cape Cod attorneys, and they're with us now in the studio to make their case. And gentlemen, welcome. Thanks for coming in. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you, Anthony. Thank you, Anthony. Thank you for having me.
And listeners, we'd like to invite you to participate in this as well. If you have a question you'd like to ask the Republican candidates for state AG, give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook at Radio Boston. Now, we flipped a coin, and Jay McMahon won. So first question to you, but I'm going to ask the same question to you, Dan Shores. Before we dive into specific issues, tell us something about your background that makes you the best candidate for Massachusetts Attorney General.
Well, I've got 6 years of law enforcement experience. I got 6 years military. I was a second lieutenant in the military police and the Army National Guard. I've been a lawyer since 1988, trial lawyer. I've had thousands of cases in the court system for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, the same place where the Attorney General operates. I have cases at every level of court. I've got civil and criminal cases. I've got a case before the SJC. I've got a couple of cases in the appeals court, a couple in the Superior Court, criminal and civil, and a couple in the district court. A handful in the district court, and some some in the probate court as well. So I do trial work. That's about all I do is trial work. I'm a litigator.
Lots of experience in the field of litigation. How about you, Dan Shores? What qualifies you to run for attorney general and to be attorney general?
First of all, I've got exceedingly strong Massachusetts roots. I'm from a blue-collar family here in Massachusetts. I put myself through college and law school. I'm a proud graduate of the Georgetown University Law Center in Washington, D.C. I was a member of the Law Review at Georgetown, and I was a member of the editorial board of the Law Review at Georgetown. And I was recruited. I worked as a litigation lawyer at two firms in high-stakes intellectual property, complex IP cases in federal district courts. I worked at two firms, one of which was called Latham & Watkins, which is a 200-plus lawyer law firm, and which is 10 times the size of the Attorney General's office. So I have large institutional experience that I bring to the table. And I'm also the chairman of the Massachusetts Maritime Academy Board of Trustees down in Buzzards Bay. That's a public administration experience that I hold. That and the MMA has a budget that exceeds $50 million, which exceeds that of the Attorney General's office. Overall, I think that what I bring to the table is a very strong reform message to get politics out of the Attorney General's office. And I'm the only candidate that has really talked about getting politics out of the AG's office and returning it to what its true purpose is.
Okay, and we're going to actually be able to spend a little time on that specific issue. But let me start with a big issue that I know is a concern to both of you and to lots of folks across Massachusetts, and that is the opioid addiction crisis. You've both said that focusing on the epidemic is one of your top priorities. What would your approach be as Attorney General? Back to you, Jay McMahon.
Okay, well, I've been campaigning on this issue, I got a three-prong approach. As you know, I got a personal experience in with this. I've lost my son to the opioid crisis. No parent should have to bury their child. And I've been campaigning, been meeting with groups, parenting support groups, and I'm finding that the government programs are a failure. Massachusetts is the medical capital of the world, and yet we can't seem to take care of this opiate crisis. Well, the truth is we can, but not through the present government programs. So I got a three-prong approach, and it goes like this. We need effective and successful rehabilitation programs. They're available, but they're private pay. They have an 87% success rate, but they're private pay programs. And I can talk about that in a little bit. The second approach is drying up the source of heroin and fentanyl, because 80% of the people in Massachusetts, the opiate addicts, are dying of heroin and fentanyl. So we got to dry up that source.
What does that mean exactly? You mean getting tougher on enforcement?
Oh, absolutely, in cooperation with the feds, because the feds know how that stuff gets in here. They don't manufacture that in Massachusetts. Fentanyl comes from China, and heroin comes from Taliban Afghanistan. They both come over the Mexico border. That's why the president wants to build a wall. He wants to stop the drugs. Collaterally, he will also control immigration. But he knows that that's how it's coming. And the feds know how that poison's coming into Massachusetts. What we need is joint federal and state task forces. But Maura Healey's not doing that. She right now is running her office as if Massachusetts was a sanctuary state. So she's not cooperating with the feds. And to me, that's an insult to any federal taxpayer in Massachusetts, because we're paying for those law enforcement assets. So that's the second approach. And my third approach would be extreme prosecution. Take them to the max. If you can tie the defendant to the drugs, put that guy away for years and years. The only way to drive it out of Massachusetts is by extreme prosecution. Not like we've seen in Salem, where the Superior Court judge let that guy go on probation who was caught with 40 bags of heroin and said to him, if you were a U.S. citizen, I'd have sent you to jail. That's the wrong message.
All right, so three approaches there. Let me ask you about one approach that Maura Healey is dealing with, and I want to get your response to it, and then I'm going to come over to you, Dan Shores. But we're going to get to Maura Healey's other lawsuits in a bit, but one of her legal actions that her office has taken is to sue Purdue Pharma over its role in the opioid epidemic.
Right.
And her case alleges that the company knowingly covered up the addiction risk, used gifts and money to reward doctors who wrote more prescriptions.
That's correct.
A lot's been written about this. You've criticized Healey for filing so many lawsuits, but there's a lot of evidence that this case might, in fact, be based on real evidence. What do you think? I mean, would you support that lawsuit?
First of all, she loves to go after soft targets. Purdue Pharma is easy to find. They're not going to go anywhere.
But not such a soft target, is that? I mean, it's a big, powerful corporation with pays folks a lot of money and has distributed a lot of drugs across society.
Oh,
right?
there's no question that they produce opioids, and there's no question that they've given incentives to doctors to meet certain quotas, and if they do meet certain quotas, right, they get certain incentives like vacations down in the Caribbean,
right,
and that
so
sort of thing.
Would you support her lawsuit?
Well, let me say this. That's one aspect of it, but that's not going to stop the heroin and the fentanyl, and that's where the real problem is. What she's doing is she's going after them as if the people on the streets, the drug pushers and traffickers, are taking drugs from Purdue Pharma, and that's not the case at all. What's happening is, in order to get any drugs from Purdue Pharma, you have to get a prescription from a physician, and then you have to go to a pharmacy. So that's already all controlled.
Okay.
She's making a big deal out of a little piece. She should go after the real drug traffickers and pushers.
All right, Jay. I want to come over to Dan now. So let me ask you about how you would approach this epidemic as Attorney General.
Yeah, and it's certainly the scourge of our time. And I've said from the beginning of the campaign, there are three areas that I'd focus on.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is education. I think that's incredibly important. This isn't an underage keg party. You know, growing up, that was really kind of one of the worst things that you could do. This is one strike and you're out. One strike and you're addicted. One strike and you're dead. Regardless, your family, yourself are affected forever. So we need to be very serious about education. And I think the Attorney General's office, the instrumentality that we put about $50 million a year into, can play a critical role in that. And that's through an intensive, more intensive Speakers Bureau program. Get to the kids, get into our schools, tell the kids, do not open this door to hell in the first place. So I think prevention is really a fundamental, most critical thing, something the AG's office can play a significant role in. Number two is healthcare. If you fall into that trap of addiction in the first place, healthcare is very important, getting folks back on their feet. I, in contrast to my opponent in this primary, do not think the Attorney General's office has a central role to play in that aspect, because it's not a healthcare provider, doesn't have the expertise. I think it can, the AG office can direct folks to the proper health care and the proper resources we have in the Commonwealth. But the third and the most important, the most fundamental aspect of this is cracking down on drug traffickers with the full force and weight of the law. The sitting Attorney General has really been very soft on crime, and it's very troubling because our Attorney General is supposed to be our chief lawyer, our stalwart for the law, our standard bearer. And this Attorney General has supported a quote, and those are her words, a safety valve for drug dealers when sitting before a judge during sentencing. And I think that's the wrong signal. As Attorney General, I would do my job. I would focus on enforcing our laws and cracking down on the drug dealers.
So, Dan, I want to follow up with you on one question about policy, and that is, in April, as you know, the state legislature passed a massive criminal justice reform package that was years in the making. Big part of that bill was getting rid of mandatory minimum sentences for low-level drug offenses. This was around concern that these minimum sentences are enforced unfairly across racial lines. And also, this was done as a way to decrease the number of incarcerations in favor of other options like diversion programs, treatment, and so forth. Do you favor that? Do you favor
No.
doing away with mandatory minimum?
No, absolutely not. I think I was very disappointed. And it wasn't just me that was disappointed. It was the majority of district attorneys who came out and spoke out against that. If you ask a district attorney, you know, whether using mandatory minimum sentencing is a valuable tool in their law enforcement efforts, they would say absolutely. You can leverage it up to get to the larger drug dealers. And so I was very disappointed. It was a very soft on crime bill. And let me just add, if I could, relating to Purdue
Yep.
Pharma, this is one area that I agree with the Attorney General on. I think it doesn't matter if you're responsible in one form or another for pushing this poison onto our streets, then you need to be held accountable. And if you're pushing physicians to prescribe 90 Oxycontin pills for a broken arm, for example, or that needs to be investigated. And if you're responsible for, because that leads to the further addiction, you should be, the law should come down on you. And I support that effort in general.
So you support that effort in general by the current attorney general. Let's take a phone call at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking to Jay McMahon and Dan Shores. They're Republicans running for attorney general. They want the, they are running against each other. The primary in September will decide which one of these two gentlemen will face Maura Healey in November. Let's go to Carly on line three. Carly, you're calling from New Bedford. Good to have you. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thank you so much. As far as the Purdue comment, I just wanted to take issue with the first speaker. I apologize.
That's Jay McMahon. That's right. Republican candidate for AG.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to say that I completely agree with the comments that were just recently made as far as how appropriate Maura Healey's actions against Purdue Pharma are. That's exactly where this problem stems from, and his kind of disregard of that action seems to show a level of misinformation about this topic that concerns me as a voter. And I also would just like to ask how either of you would reduce the disparate impact of mandatory minimums, the impact that they have on female offenders. Thank you.
All right, let's do the first one. Jay McMahon, why don't you respond to Carly's concern about the Purdue Pharma case?
Well, again, we were just talking about Purdue Pharma. They're not producing fentanyl that's going on the streets or the heroin. That's 80% of what our people are dying from. They're producing prescription drugs, which are being in the marketplace through pharmacies and through prescriptions issued by doctors. So, I mean, I beg to disagree. I know that the true statistics are showing the deaths of opiate addicts. Again, 80% of them are dying in Massachusetts by heroin and fentanyl. So let me go on to mandatory minimum sentencing. I am in favor of minimum sentencing, and I am in favor of enforcing them. We just had a police officer on Cape Cod that was killed several months ago because of a perpetrator who had pleaded guilty in 2010 to 27 counts of illegal possession of a firearm. In Massachusetts, we still have a law called the Bartley-Fox Law, which is a one-year minimum jail sentence for each count of illegal possession of a firearm. They're now referring to that perpetrator, the person who killed Officer Sean Gannon down in Cape Cod, the Yarmouth police officer, they're referring to the killer as 125. That's 125 convictions he's got on his adult criminal record. If 125 was sentenced, minimum sentences of 1 year for each count in 2010, he would have been in jail till 2037, or 2037, in which case, at the end of his shift, Sergeant Sean Gannon would have gone home to his wife and family and not to the morgue. So minimum sentencing can save people's lives, especially law enforcement. And we need to send the message to law enforcement that we have their back. And we also need to send a message to traffickers of this poison, purveyors of this poison. We need to let them know that Massachusetts is no longer open for business.
All right, Jay McMahon, I want to move on to Dan Shores and give you a chance to respond to the caller's question about the disparate impact of mandatory minimum sentencing.
Yeah, so, I mean, I indicated what my, you know, general position on mandatory minimum sentencing, and I think it actually opens up a larger issue. And I think that this is really fundamentally why I'm running for the Attorney General's office, is that because the law is not being respected. We need to have an Attorney General who is tough on crime, who represents the law. We need to have an Attorney General who's not in favor of Massachusetts becoming a sanctuary state. And back to the mandatory minimum sentencing issue just for a second, if we look at the Wayne Chapman case, the recent Wayne Chapman case, if there's ever a time to have a mandatory minimum sentence, it's for an individual who commits a violent sexual crime against a child in Massachusetts. And so I think there's room to be very tough on crime. There's certain areas that we need to do that. We need to respect the rule of law. It goes all the way down to, it opens up to the illegal immigration issue and all the way down the line. I think we're seeing, what we see right now in Massachusetts is this trend where our law enforcement officials our public officials are favoring issues and matters that are against the law. And that's very troubling. That strikes at the heart of our Commonwealth, all the way back to the founding of John Adams and John Adams's Constitution. He stood for the law. He represented the law. He believed in the law. He believed in this country. He believed in this Commonwealth. And right now, we're heading in a direction that's very dangerous. And frankly, that's why I'm running. I'm running to get politics out of the office of Attorney General and to bring that instrumentality back to where it's supposed to be.
Let's take another call. Let's go to David from Somerville, who's got a question. Go ahead, David. You're on the air. Thanks for the call.
No problem. Thanks for having me. So I know that it's really important for the Attorney General to cooperate with the governor's office to ensure that there's effective law enforcement. So I know that Charlie Baker is facing a primary opponent. So I was just wondering what your stances were on whether you support Governor Baker or Scott Lively.
Scott Lively, of course, picked up about 30% of Republican delegates at the Republican state party convention. I'll start with you on this one, Dan Shores. Do you support Charlie Baker for governor or Scott Lively?
I first of all, do not support Scott Lively. I certainly support the governor. Let me start there. I support Governor Baker. I do not support Scott Lively. Scott Lively's record with respect to discrimination is abysmal, and I don't think he's a proper representative of our Republican Party. I fully support Governor Baker. I believe that his – now, I don't agree with him on a number of issues, okay? So, but there are – centrally, the governor is
– Got it.
Is, okay.
I want to try to move through this issue pretty quickly because there's some other issues I want to cover, But, Jay McMahon, quick answer from you on this question. Scott
yes.
Lively or Charlie Baker?
I'm with Governor Baker. Governor Baker and I have talked about the opiate crisis and what my passion is behind it. Came up to me. He had learned within the last year that I had lost a son to the opiate crisis, and he came up to me, and we discussed that, and we discussed some of my points, what I'm trying to do and what I would do as Attorney General, that my three-prong approach, how I would go after the opiate crisis and tackle it and do something more than just sit by and watch deaths by opiate addiction quadruple each year. It's abysmal of what's happening in Massachusetts.
Okay, just to fact check that. So the number of deaths due to opioid-related overdoses fell by about 10% between the year before and last year. So,
how about since 2011 when they've quadrupled?
But doesn't it mean that given that there has been some progress, that somebody out there, whether it's Governor Baker, whether it's a combination of lawmakers, the legislature is doing something right here?
No, it just means that it's the ebb and flow. It's when the real facts all come in, when the real statistics all come in, when they final total everything, you're going to see that it's on average.
All right. I want to move on a little bit and talk about Maura Healey's many lawsuits and legal actions against the Trump administration, something like 26 to date. You both say that Healey's lawsuits are what? Let me start with you, Dan Shores. You're not a big fan of what she's been doing here. Tell us why.
Anthony, we put, as I said before, about $45 to $50 million a year into the Attorney General's office. And that budget supports a staff of a little over 200 attorneys. And so that objective of that office is to enforce the laws here in Massachusetts to protect our people. I think the running tally is over 40 lawsuits or other legal actions that this Attorney General has signed on to against the White House. And that's compared to zero against the Obama administration. So any rational person will look at that and say that's politically motivated. But the larger issue here, I want to stop you there because
a lot of Republican attorneys general over the course of the Obama administration also challenged him. I mean, this isn't something that Democratic attorney generals have invented.
I'm not saying they invented it, but they've taken it to a whole new level.
Yeah.
But the important point here is if you're the person that's responsible for ensuring that our laws are enforced and our people are protected, every lawsuit that this attorney general files against the Trump administration means that one more opioid dealer goes free or one more public official that commits an act of corruption and gets away with it or one more senior who's defrauded. And so she's directing the resources, significant resources, towards politics and to advance, frankly, her own political career and not to help our people here in Massachusetts. I don't care what party you're from, that's wrong. As Attorney General, I will reform the office and get politics out.
All right. Well, let's hear from the Attorney General on this issue, because we've spoken to her about this very thing, and she says essentially that this isn't about politics. It's about enforcing the law and protecting the citizens of the Commonwealth. Here's Maura Healey.
This is about fighting to ensure that women have access to reproductive health care, fighting to make sure that students aren't getting ripped off, fighting to make sure we don't go backwards when it comes to combating climate change and meeting our climate goals for a clean energy economy here in Massachusetts. It's about fighting to ensure that people have access to health care. It's about standing up for civil rights and making sure that when it comes to something like our census, everyone is in fact counted.
So, Jay McMahon, let me come to you. Aren't those issues that an attorney general, a state attorney general, should be paying attention to?
Those are the only issues she pays attention to. She doesn't do anything at all about public safety. And when you talk, and you were asking us a little while ago about the civil suits that she's been filing against the Trump administration, you only have to look at the first one to see that it's all just a matter of her own political activism. And it is against our public safety interests. For instance, her first lawsuit against Trump was to block his temporary travel ban. Now, the president knows that his responsibility is to keep Americans safe. He got intelligence information from the Obama administration, the holdover from the Obama administration, that there were elements of ISIS and Al-Qaeda coming in from the refugees of six Middle Eastern states, coming in here to kill us. And the president took action and tried to protect us with a temporary travel ban. Now, Maura Healey, knowing that her number one responsibility and priority is to keep citizens of the Commonwealth safe, she went against our public interests and went in to try to block the administration. And you got to ask yourself, who's she representing? The foreign nationals of those six Middle Eastern states? Because she certainly isn't representing us when she's acting against our public interest.
Yeah, but what about, the issue in that lawsuit and trying to ban that travel ban early on? I mean, this was a very broad ban that was keeping academics out of Massachusetts. It was keeping all kinds of people who were involved in productive in legal ways in Massachusetts. So there was a real concern about that.
Yeah, but she went in and said that these foreign nationals have a civil right to be here. They don't. In fact, she manufactured or made up civil rights that don't exist. And when you put that in contrast to what she did just 6 months before in July of 2016 with her infamous enforcement order against certain guns in Massachusetts, she can't even read the Constitution where it says that those rights should not be infringed, and yet she makes up civil rights when she goes and files a lawsuit against Trump. So
wait a minute, we're mixing issues here. Because
I'm not. I'm actually going at the issues.
Okay, but we're talking about Second Amendment rights, and I know Maura Healey has been pretty tough on enforcing Massachusetts gun laws. And let me ask you about that. This is a state because of its very tough gun laws, arguably. It's one of the reasons why we've got some of the lowest rate of gun deaths per person in all 50 states. Maura Healey is in favor of those laws, works hard to enforce them. Do you take issue with that?
I most certainly do, because all her enforcement action has been against licensed gun owners. And by and large in Massachusetts, licensed gun owners do not commit gun crimes. And yet she goes after soft targets, and she goes after restricting licensed gun owners. Yeah. It does nothing for guns that are on the street.
All right, Jay, I'm going to jump in because I want to give Dan a chance on this gun issue. I mean, Maura Healey, among other things, sent a notice to gun sellers and manufacturers that the state would be cracking down on the sale of illegal assault weapons. Good use of the Attorney General's time?
No, I think a better use of the time would be to clarify the law. I think what this attorney general did was it was a piece of legislation, if you look at it, copies and duplicates. And the legislation that this attorney general's office produced was very ambiguous. If you ask, if you ever go out and actually visit with, and be, I'm a gun owner, visit with and are among folks that own firearms in Massachusetts, they are law-abiding citizens, and they believe in their constitutional right, their Second Amendment right. And I think that's so important. I think it was really troubling to watch this attorney general bypass the legislature and the governor to really issue her own law and to put an unconst what I believe is still an unconstitutional order over the heads of law-abiding people in our Commonwealth.
But let me ask you,
they deserve a voice as well.
Right, but this general idea that gun laws are somehow going after law-abiding gun owners, I mean, I've talked to lots of gun owners who say they have no problem with reasonable gun control measures. I mean, do you take issue with that general idea that there isn't room for Second Amendment rights that upholds folks' right to have a gun, but reasonable gun control laws?
Massachusetts has the toughest and most stringent laws on the books. But what happens is, and this is what bothers me and bothers a lot of people, is there'll be one of these horrible mass shootings, mostly in our schools, and it creates a political momentum. And so the first step that the folks from the left take is to just seize guns. And that's not really the approach. Now, here's what bothered me about the red flag bill.
Where are people seizing guns?
Well, that's
what, we've got strict laws in Massachusetts, but as a result, we've got some of the lowest rate of gun deaths per person in all 50 states.
Talk to us in several years, because I think people see that's where this is heading. Now, I'm a problem solver, okay? And so if you look at the issue with respect to school, I'd like to see all this political will that we've received be used to secure our schools. My wife was a teacher on Cape Cod. The school that she taught at did not have a lock on her door. I was afraid. She used to have drills. I was afraid that there was something happening and that she would be in danger. We need to have officers present on schools. We need to secure our schools. I was very disappointed in the red flag bill. We need to have some in the sense that it didn't address these fundamental issues. The problem solving is make our kids safe, give the local instrumentalities funding so that they can secure their schools. Now, that is the type of common sense legislation that we need, that the AG's office should be getting behind, not a witch hunt and a diversion away from the real problems that we have.
Well, I just want to again say that whether you like the laws or not, they seem to be doing pretty good work with the lowest rate of gun deaths per person in all 50 states. But we've got to move on.
You're making it like as if she issues this order in July of 2016 and something happened.
Yeah.
Nothing happened. It was her solution to a non-existent problem to begin with.
Okay, no, I hear your guys' position loud and clear on this. I want to move on to one more issue, because we're really approaching the last minute of this debate. You're both talking a lot about things that Attorney General Maura Healey is doing wrong, but only one of you is going to face her in November. So what's the biggest difference between you two? Let me start with you, Jay McMahon. What's the difference here between you and Dan Shores?
Well, I've said it before. Dan Shores is a nice guy. I actually like him. But I'll tell you,
thanks. I appreciate
that. But here's the difference. I mean, I've been a trial lawyer.
And I'm going to ask you to wrap this up in 30 seconds, then I got to come over to Dan Shores.
I've been a trial lawyer since 1988. I have thousands of cases, 30 years in Massachusetts jurisprudence. I have cases in every court that the Attorney General operates in.
All right.
So I've got law enforcement experience, I've got military experience, and I've got 30 years here in Massachusetts. I have all kinds of criminal cases, all kinds of civil cases, and all kinds of consumer protection cases.
Got it. So we're
I do it.
All right. I have very
I'm
strong,
the guy.
Go
I
ahead,
have
Dan.
Very strong litigation experience, deep, complex cases, multi-billion dollar cases. Some of them are. I'm a graduate of Georgetown Law. I have all the confidence in the world that I can handle this job. The Attorney General is not a trial lawyer. The Attorney General does not appear in court to handle drunk driving cases, for example. The Attorney General has an administrative position. I'm the only candidate in this primary that has the significant public administration experience, and I have a broad legal experience. I also have a technical background, which means that issues like energy, issues like cybersecurity are right in my wheelhouse, and unfortunately, my opponent doesn't have that background.
All right, we're going to wrap it up there. Dan Shores, Republican candidate for Massachusetts Attorney General, and Jay McMahon, Republican candidate for Massachusetts Attorney General. Thank you both for coming in today. I really appreciated the spirited conversation.
Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you, Anthony.
Listeners, stay with us. Just ahead, Senator Elizabeth Warren on why she's opposing the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and let's return to our top story today, reaction to President Trump's nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court. Senate Democrats are opposing the nomination, which would push the court further to the right. Among those vowing to fight is Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who joins us now from Washington. Senator, good to have you back on the program.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
And you tweeted this morning that you'll be voting no on the appointment of Brett Kavanaugh. Tell us why.
Brett Kavanaugh is a political animal. He's been sitting on a pre-approved list of right-wing nominees for months now. You know, let's be clear. He didn't end up on that list because he is a middle-of-the-road consensus pick. He ended up there because of his record as a judge and as a lawyer is clear, and because of the political work he has done. He opposed a ruling that upheld health care, that held up health care for millions of Americans. He opposed a decision protecting women's access to contraception under the Affordable Care Act. He's opposed to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He's opposed to corporate accountability. He's opposed to the rights of women, the rights of workers, the rights of consumers. Look, I read his opinions, and basically, he's hostile to just about anybody.
So, Senator, what's the
wealthy and powerful?
Yeah, and what's your biggest concern? Because there's a long trail of legal writings there. What gives you most pause about Brett Kavanaugh? I mean, go ahead.
Can I give you three? Because they really do. Because we're talking about someone who'll be there for a generation and help influence that court, the deciding vote. So, one is that he's hostile to health care, to the Affordable Care Act.
How so? How do we know that?
Well, we know this because of the opinions he's already issued, both dissenting, wanting to roll back the Affordable Care Act. And we have opinions right now pending in the lower courts that are going to come up to the Supreme Court on things like whether or not insurance companies can discriminate against people with pre-existing conditions. And the Trump administration says, sure they can. So I worry about health care for all Americans.
Mm-hmm.
I worry about Roe versus Wade. Nobody made it onto this list who hadn't pre-screened to commit to overturn Roe versus Wade. The president said that. The Federalist Society that put this list together has said that. And the third thing that worries me is that he has written an article saying, in effect, that presidents like Trump should be above the law. They should not be subjected to investigations. I want you to think about that. Not to the kind of investigation that Richard Nixon was subjected to, that Bill Clinton was subjected to. No, that presidents are above the law. And that's at a moment when this president is under enormous pressure from investigations that get closer and closer, more indictments, more guilty pleas of people close to Donald Trump. And, you know, you can hear the hoofbeats. Donald Trump can hear the hoofbeats.
So I want to ask you about
investigation bearing down on him. And I don't want to see a deciding vote in the United States Supreme Court that says, hey, let the president do whatever the president wants. Because in America, nobody is above the law.
But Senator,
that includes the president of the United States.
Yeah, and I hear you on that. But I want to ask you about this. Would this necessarily be an issue that would even come before him? I mean, let's say Trump gets into hot water because of Bob Mueller's investigation. The response is going to be political. That is, it's going to be up to you guys in Congress to act, to impeach or not to impeach. Would Judge Kavanaugh necessarily even be in a position to weigh in on this?
Well, it is possible that the only response will be political, but it is also possible that the response will be a criminal indictment. Remember, that's how Watergate started.
Mm-hmm.
It was a criminal break-in and a criminal cover-up that was fostered by the President of the United States. And the very fact that the President of the United States, Richard Nixon, had potential criminal liability that started moving Congress toward impeachment and, of course, ultimately for President Nixon to spare the country that and to resign. But as soon as you take criminal responsibility off the table for exactly one American, everybody else has to follow the law, but not the President of the United States, then you've rearranged everything. You've changed fundamentally what the Constitution of the United States says. You've changed fundamentally the balance of power in this country. And I don't want to see a Supreme Court justice who says, let me start out by issuing a free pass to Donald Trump. I think that would be a mistake.
Our time is running out, but I want to be able to ask you a quick question about Roe v. Wade. And let me ask you about this. I know that a lot of people are concerned about a more conservative point overturning Roe v. Wade. Susan Collins said last week, maybe not. This, after all, is Justice John Roberts' court. He's known as an incrementalist. He's expressed support for the idea of precedent. Does that give you any kind of security that in a Roberts court, maybe a law that has stayed on the books for 40 years would stay there?
Really? Were you around last week when Justice Roberts helped lead a 5-4 majority in overturning decades of settled law of precedent on public unions? The Janus case was exactly that. They just tossed out the law that had been there. I understand that Roberts said back when he was up as a nominee, oh, I will respect precedent. I'll just call balls and strikes. But the reality has not been that. Same thing on Citizens United, on money and politics. This has been a court, and Justice Roberts has been a justice who has said, you know, all those decades and decades of law that are all well-established and well-founded and well-grounded and been the bargain we've all worked on, nah, we're actually willing to throw them out because today we have a more conservative point of view and we want to see our preferred policy positions go forward. In other words, in the case of Janus, they really want to try to break the backs of America's unions, and they were willing to throw out decades of precedent to do it. So does that make me feel secure about Roe versus Wade? Nope. In fact, his history makes me more alarmed that this is a court that will be willing, if it gets 5 votes, to throw out Roe versus Wade.
All right. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, that's all we've got time for today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. That's it for today. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.